This is NDPR's Jazz Beat. I'm Tom Reaney with a podcast edition of my jazz blog, which you can find at nepr.net. With summer now in season, we're looking forward to the third annual Jazz and Roots Festival taking place at Court Square in downtown Springfield on Saturday, August 6th. It's free and open to the public, and it's a wonderful opportunity to see the community come together in a celebration of jazz and roots music. Jazz highlights this summer will include Joey DeFrancesco, Terry Lynn Carrington, and Taj Mahal. And here on Jazz Beat, you'll have a chance to preview the lineup as we hear from some of the performers who are coming out to join us for the festival. Today, my guest is Joey DeFrancesco. I'm Tom Reaney, host of Jazz on the Mode here on New England Public Radio, speaking today with Joey DeFrancesco, the great Hammond B3 organist and trumpeter and singer, who'll be playing the Jazz and Roots Festival in Springfield at Court Square on Saturday, August 6th. And Joey, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to the airwaves of New England Public Radio today. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joey, you're from, you'll be in Springfield on the 6th, and I noticed that, strictly speaking, it appears as though you were born in Springfield Township, Pennsylvania.
That's correct, yes. same name city, that's right.
I think of you as Philadelphia through and through, and of course that's what you are, and you play an instrument that's famously associated with Philadelphia, the Hammond organ, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on why Philadelphia became such a center for the Hammond B3.
Yeah, it's a very, it's a great town for that. I mean, I think the big reason is the fact that Jimmy Smith, you know, was from Norristown, Pennsylvania, which was very close to Philadelphia. Him playing and becoming such a phenomenon, and everybody in the area basically heard what he was doing and became players because Jimmy McGriff is from Philadelphia. Shirley Scott, Groove Holmes was from Camden, New Jersey, which is just right across the bridge, basically is Philadelphia. Sure. You know, Charles Erlin, Trudy Pitts, all these people were there in Philly. So that's what really started that whole thing. And it was an ironic thing that I was born in Philly because my family is all from Niagara Falls, New York. Oh. And my dad and mom and dad moved to Philadelphia in 67, and I was born there in 71. So they made it possible for me to be part of the lineage of the people from Philadelphia that play jazz organ.
Mm-hmm. Now, was your father already an organist himself before he moved to Philly?
He had just started. He started playing around. I know he used to tell the story. He was a trumpet player first. He heard Jimmy Smith in 1959, and a few years later, he got an organ. And by the time he went to Philly, yeah, he was playing for about 3 or 4 years, and he had his B3, stuff like that. And that's when it all started.
Mm-hmm. Today is Monday, July 25th, when we're speaking, and it happens to be the birthday anniversary of Johnny Hodges. Hodges, in the mid-60s, made a lot of sessions with the organist Wild Bill Davis. Do you have... And while Bill worked out of Atlantic City, I know a good deal. Do you have a sense of Wild Bill in the lineage?
Oh yeah, of course. Really, he was really one of the. You know, that's who influenced Jimmy Smith. Mm-hmm. Wild Bill Davis. Jimmy's father took him to Atlantic City to hear this. He wanted to hear. You got to hear this guy play this instrument, which was fairly new at the time, playing jazz and playing the bass part with your left hand and your foot on the organ. And I talked to Jimmy about that many times. And he heard that, just went crazy, and he wanted to play that instrument. So, yeah, Wild Bill really is the first guy that approached the organ playing the bass line and everything in that way that we still play it now. He just had more of a big band approach, and that's why, like, things like April in Paris, mm-hmm. a lot of people still don't know that was originally done with an organ trio, and then was then rearranged for the Basie band, pretty much the exact arrangement that they were playing in Atlantic City, you know?
Sure, yep, mm-hmm. And I think that
in fact, the original Count Basie recording, Frank West told me that Wild Bill Davis was supposed to play on that with the big band, but the organ was broken in the studio that day.
No kidding. Huh.
Yes. Yeah.
I saw Wild Bill with the Duke Ellington Orchestra several times in the early 70s, mostly. He was touring with the band, and of course, he played on Blues for New Orleans with Hodges on the Ellington New Orleans Suite around that time, too.
That's right, and that's great. You know, and I, you know, a lot of people really don't know about that, you know, and that's pretty pretty big that, you know, Duke loved the organ like that, you know, Wild Bill playing with it. With the Ellington Orchestra, you know, started with the Sacred Works, you know. So that's where that all started. But yeah, Blues for New Orleans is great. I love that.
Yeah, well, that was Johnny Hodges' last recording. And I think that I think Wild Bill worked with Louis Jordan earlier on. Probably playing piano as well as organ with the Timpani Five back in the day. We've already mentioned that your father played B3, and I'm assuming that that's how you were attracted to the instrument, too. Was it right there in your home?
Yeah, I would have to say that, you know, if it wasn't in the home, I probably wouldn't have, you know, in all the great records. So I was naturally attracted to it. I loved the sound, and I wanted to play it, you know. And I started playing when I was very young, and I couldn't leave it alone.
And you were playing out around Philly while you were still in grade school, right?
Oh, yeah. We were playing all around Philly, and I started very young. I started playing my own gigs probably when I was around 9 or 10, you know.
Working with Hank Mobley, Philly Joe, Major Cats like
right.
that?
Yeah, and it's funny when I talk about that now, you know, I realize how crazy that is, how amazing that is, you know, to be able to do that even now, if they were around, how excited I would be to do that. And they were so wonderful and cool to me. And I learned so much, you know,
I would almost anticipate you'd be more excited today than,
probably.
Yeah.
I think I would be, you know, 'cause as a kid, you know, you realize, you know, I kind of realized what I was doing, but not to the extent, thank goodness, too, because I probably would have just froze, you know,
right.
being that young.
Sure.
But, yeah, to do it now, like when I get to play with George Coleman and Jimmy Cobb, you know, Charles McPherson, I got to play. You know, these guys are masters, and they're such huge influences and big forces in the music. And I still think that they have a lot to offer and you know, innovation because of the way they improvise, you know.
Joey, I was, I guess it was around 2 years ago, I happened upon, I guess it was YouTube footage of Miles Davis's appearance on the Philadelphia TV talk show Time Out with Bill Boggs. And,
right.
and of course, Miles is just so compelling that I watched the entire 48 minutes or so of that hour minus the ads. And lo and behold, there you are with Chris McBride and John Swanna. I recognized John right away. And tell us a little bit about that. Where were you, at the Philadelphia Academy of the Arts at that time?
Yeah, we went to the High School for Creative and Performing Arts. And I remember we got called into the office one day, and they said, well, we're going to do a TV show here. And, you know, well, that show was on every morning. It was called Time Out. It was Bill Boggs' show. And he had everybody on there, you know. But it was explained to us that they were going to have Miles Davis on the show. So they wanted to bring in four trumpet players from Philly. Mm-hmm. Most of them were still in school. John Swanna was in college at that point. And they wanted us to be the rhythm section and play, like, you know, in between commercials and all that kind of stuff. So that's what we did. And we got like, oh my gosh, you know, Miles Davis, holy cow, you know, going crazy. So that's what we did. And we went on there and, you know, there really wasn't much solo room, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But John Swanna said, once you play a chorus of blue, you know, of yourself but coming into the tune, you know, And that one chorus of blues, man, got me to gig with Miles Davis.
Isn't that something? I can remember Miles. I think Bill is, you know, the as you mentioned, two or three trumpeters, and then John Swanna. And I remember Miles actually talks with John. He engages him a little bit in conversation, asking him about maybe some new electronic instrument. And then he says to Boggs, "Who's the rhythm section?" And and there you
No, he actually said, "What's your organ player's name?"
Ah.
That's exactly what he said.
Cool.
And I froze, you know, because the first thing I'm thinking, here we are in my hometown. Everybody's watching. It was live.
Mm-hmm.
And Miles is going to say something, like, really bad, you know? Who knew? You know?
Right.
And, you know, and after there, after we finished, he punched me in the chest and said, "You could play," and took my phone number. And that was, like, October of 87, and then I joined him almost a year later, August of 88, is when he called me.
I just found a YouTube clip that appeared in April of this year of you and Miles, Kenny Garrett, and the band in Warsaw playing Tutu.
Mm-hmm.
Have you looked at that?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I had that when it first, you know, when we did the gig. I remember we all got videos of that, and then I lost my video, so I was really happy to see that come on YouTube. I don't know if I should say that or not.
Well, I got to tell you, I wrote a blog. I do a regular blog here for New England Public Radio. And a couple of years ago, I posted a feature that I called Miles Davis and the Young Philadelphians about that Bill Boggs show. And I included the YouTube link to the show. And just this morning, when I found the Tutu cut, I added that to the blog. So it's updated in that way on our website, at least.
Oh, that's great.
And I gave a little plug to John Swanna, who compared with you and Chris McBride, I think is still a relatively unknown, unsung trumpet master who's made a lot of great records. And
he's a great player. I don't know if you know, he's actually switched to trombone now.
No, I think someone mentioned that to me a year or two ago, and I didn't follow up on it. But really? Hmm.
Yeah, he plays that just great. So he doesn't play trumpet anymore. He's trombone player now. Valve trombone.
No kidding. Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Wow. How about your own trumpet playing?
Well, yeah, I'm doing a lot of that. I've been doing, you know, I loved it. I started playing, you know, when I was right around the time I was with Miles, just after that. Mm-hmm. And that's what inspired me to play, being around that. And I played it pretty consistently through my career, and then I took a little hiatus from it a few years back, but the last 5 years, I've been really on the case with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. It's a nice instrument. It's a nice, it helps what I'm doing on the keyboard, too, you know?
How so?
So, well, because the breathing aspect, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just keep playing. I'm not Clark Terry, man. Clark Terry can circular breathe, you know.
Sure.
He can play nonstop.
Right. God bless him.
But, mm-hmm. Oh, man. Yeah, he was the greatest.
Sure.
So, but, you know, like, when you're playing the organ, you could just keep going. You don't, and there's no nonstop. So, and I try to, and I was doing that, I realized that when I first started playing the trumpet, that when you're playing and then you take a deep breath, you know, so I try to exhale while I'm playing keys, like mm-hmm. when I'm playing the notes. And then when I run out of breath, I lift my hand off the organ, you know, so
mm-hmm.
it allows me to play with more space, you know, which is always the goal, which is always getting more and more into that. And that was the big thing with Miles. That's what made Miles so amazing, you know, was the fact that he played, he was a masterful trumpet player, but he played space.
Sure.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of time, that's what's more important than the notes is what you don't play. You know, that's a big cliche, but it's a true fact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's why, and I recorded some trumpet years ago, and then I didn't for a while, so that's what's been nice to my last record, Trip Mode, which is still my latest record. It's been out for a minute. I played trumpet on, I think, 3 or 4 tracks on there. That's probably the most trumpet playing I've done on any recording.
Mm-hmm. And you'll be playing some in Springfield on August 6th?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I use it on every gig, at least on one tune, a ballad or something.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You stylistically, you've touched, a lot of bases. I hear a lot of modal playing in your work, and but bebop seems to be foundational. Is that the case? And is that what you'd recommend?
Definitely.
Is that what you'd recommend to anyone getting into this music?
Well, Tom, for me, knowing your history is very important. You know, it's kind of like when you're born and, you learn how to speak from your parents, and that's the language that you play. And if they speak a couple of languages, you speak both of those languages, So mm-hmm. for me, whatever I listen to, when I start, I was listening to music right away, and I can remember even before I played, I remember hearing organ, the records that were on a turntable. And then when I started playing, I realized now there's a vocabulary you're learning. And playing around chords, big part of playing straight ahead jazz is playing around very intricate sets of chord changes. Mm-hmm. And to really do that, you have to learn how to play things that other people were playing, like Charlie Parker and Dizzy, all of this, the bebop. And that's the main, that's like the canvas. And then after that, you add all the other extensions to the harmony. And then I realized there really is not any wrong notes. If you play them, it's rhythm, and if you play one note that might be a little funny, the next note will make that note right, mm-hmm. Once you get the confidence in your plan where you can improvise without thinking about anything. And I've been doing that for a long time, and I pretty much was doing that from day one. I never had to think about what I was doing. So there's some natural abilities that are in there that I can't explain. I can't begin to explain what they are. But as I get older and I learn more about harmony and things, it's constant. It's never-ending learning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I like to teach, too, because I could, when I can, because I like to explain all these things, Because mm-hmm. a lot of these things you can't learn out of a book. Most of them you can't. It's about doing it. But there's certain fundamentals, and you got to listen to a lot of records. So I just give you a very long explanation of what my style is. My style is everything, but yes, the canvas is bebop. There's mm-hmm. no question.
Mm-hmm. Listening to you I know this is kind of a VSOP a tour, but with John McLaughlin and Elvin Jones playing My Favorite Things, for instance, it's, the John Coltrane model is one of the great innovative uses of modes in modern music. And mm-hmm. But I was listening to your recording, too, of Billie Jean on your tribute to Michael Jackson, and I noticed, you go into modes on that as well with... I think it's Byron Landham and Paul Bolenbach. And I wonder if you're drawn to modes, because I've heard you talk and read of your, you easily kind of comfortably invoke the, the concept of spirituality in music. And I wonder if you find that that there's a connection that you feel between spirituality and the use of modes.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Yeah, and that when you can get, I call it being in the zone, mm-hmm. and you can match spirituality with feeling of what you're doing, then you can. It's like that's the best feeling in the world. I think they all go together. Playing one change, one chord, and playing over that, which modes you play, mm-hmm. or a couple of chords and. It's just got, there's a certain vibe, certain chords, and even, when somebody plays a gong or something like that, mm-hmm. the overtones of that,
mm-hmm.
it's very, I feel a certain, there's tones in there that are definitely, it's all based on spirituality, and not to make anybody think I'm like a religious freak or anything, because I'm not, but I feel very strongly about that. And that's certain music. That's why when people hear it, they get moved, you know. It's not just notes or classical kind of, you know, kind of stuff. It's which classical is great. And what a lot of people forget is that the guys that composed all that, well, they composed it, but they were improvising. That's how you compose. Difference is they play that the same every time because those guys wrote it down.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but improvisation was part of the process of discovery and invention and working things out.
When you listen to Bach and Beethoven and Mozart, I mean, they were improvising. They just happened to write it down.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Sure. Mm-hmm. So everybody else wouldn't ruin it.
Exactly. So that's the beauty of what we're doing. But, I mean, that's everything we're doing, though. You know, when you talk about innovative and new music, it becomes individuals who have something to say because of who they are and the way it comes out when they say it, because there's only 12 notes. And they've all been played countless amount of times. So, okay, you might learn everything from Charlie Parker, because really, we haven't gone much past that as far as what to do around chords. And people didn't even realize how advanced he was until they started coming out with some of these bootleg things. Mm-hmm. He was stretching and playing a lot of things that we thought Coltrane was playing first, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then the extensions of all these different things, and it becomes how the people, you know, you might be influenced by somebody, but nobody can sound, I would hope, nobody can sound just like somebody. Something might remind you of somebody else or something like that. But still, if you have a real ear and you really listen, you should be able to tell a difference that it's not this person or that person. You know, that used to drive me crazy. I mean, people would say that I sounded just like Jimmy Smith. Well, I'm thinking, do you have ears?
Right.
Thank for the compliment, because I love Jimmy Smith. But really, my whole concept, there's things that came from that. And the thing about Jimmy was his feel was amazing. And I think probably my spirit and the way things come out have that feel. So regardless of what I play, it may remind you of that a little bit, because that's the sound and the feel, right? But,
mm-hmm.
you know, my lines and things are very more, there are a lot more, there's a lot more things going on, because I had a much bigger body of work to go back and listen to and study than he did when he was doing his thing, you know. And that's why each generation, there's no excuse. People need to be taking things, you know, to another level, because now you have so much, there's access to so many things to learn. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing you got to do, though, is find your soul and find, you got to play the blues, because all of it is, everything we're doing is blues. No matter how out it gets, it's all coming from the blues. So, you know, that's first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Miles used to say all the time. I'd say, hey, Miles, you sound so great. Or, you know, that was some crazy stuff you played. And he used to say, I'm just tooting the blues.
Speaking of Jimmy Smith, when I was a kid getting into this music, mostly as a listener, and a really frustrated saxophone player, I abandoned that a long time ago, but there were two people who really impressed me because they played, you know, what I think of as electric instruments. B.B. King, I recognized the sound of one note by B.B. King, and I was really mystified by that when I first began listening to the music. Why do I know that's B.B. and not Muddy Waters or Freddie King or Michael Bloomfield or whomever? And in the same way, Jimmy Smith impressed me. I mean, it used to just amaze me that nobody else sounded like Jimmy Smith at the same instrument, you know? And so
that,
the emphasis that you're placing on the individuality of sound, of speech, of style, I really appreciate it, and especially in that context. I mean, it would just blow me away that Jimmy Smith would, like, you know, play one chord, and I'd be like, nobody else on the planet is going to sound like that. You know?
Yeah, even if they play the exact same thing. And that was also the beauty of he was, you know, it was kind of like, you know, he was way far above everybody else. I mean, let's be honest, he really was. Mm. But at the same time, I love the other guys for other things they did and their styles and what they brought to it, you know. Mm. And they all had a little bit in there, but you could always tell the difference. And that's important, individuality, you know.
Sure, sure. When you come to Springfield, who'll be with you?
It's my trio, and we've been together. We also, the last record featured them. And we've been together about a little over a year and a half now. And it's Jason Brown, his drummer. He's from New York.
Great drummer.
And a guitar player by the name of Dan Wilson, who's from Akron, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And they're just some bad dudes, man. We get some stuff going together. And that's what we'll be in Springfield with. And we're going to fire it up for everybody.
Great. I wonder if I know that you know, we've already talked about it. So, you know, you had the connection with Miles. You toured with him there in 88. Did you see the Don Cheadle movie Miles Ahead?
I did.
Would you care to express anything about it?
Well, I won't go into it a lot, but I will say that I saw it twice now. Mm. I saw it in a theater, and then I saw it on an airplane just recently flying over to Australia because I wanted to see it again. You know, because I know Miles, I knew him really well. There's two things I can say. First of all, he would have loved it. I know he would have loved. He would have thought it was fantastic. So, in that regard, you know, I say, you know what? What's wrong with that? It's like as if Miles Davis played in a movie that was like a fantasy action movie. If he was in it himself,
right? Sure.
And that's how it starts. I mean, if people real pay attention, you know, he tells the reporter that's interviewing me in the beginning of the movie, if you're going to tell a story, tell it with some attitude. And to him, that meant a little bit of, you know, let's put a little Hollywood action, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what the guy did. You know, he said, well, how would you tell it, Miles? And Miles told it in this crazy way, you know, kind of like what he did with music. There were things in the movie that were very, you know, the dynamic between him and Francis, his wife. Mm-hmm. Those things were all very, very accurate. You know, when they had a big feature and that part where he calls the radio station and all that, that really happened. You know, things like that.
Calling Phil Shapp.
You know. Yeah, exactly. And then, so if you look at it from that perspective, you know, it's cool. It's a well-done movie. I enjoyed it. But, I knew ahead of time, you know,
sure,
what it was going to be. I talked to his nephew about it, too, before I saw it, Vince Wilburn. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm getting ready to go. Say, let me know what you think. But realize it's not a biopic. But, you know, they said that a lot. So people going to expect to see Miles playing in the farm when he was 11 years old and going to New York to hang out with Bird and Charlie Parker and all. We all wanted to see that, you know, because that's, we love all that stuff, you know.
Sure.
But that's not what the movie was. Of course, there's a lot of fantasy in there. Like I said, Miles wasn't running around with a gun. Those things with the record company and George Butler and Lost Tapes, none of that happened. That was all fiction, you know.
Sure.
So, you know, there's that. And so the other side of me is, okay, well, you know, it said Wynton Kelly was on piano at Birdland when they had Bill Evans down there playing with him. So, you know, I'm a stickler for these little
sure
things.
Sure, oh, sure.
You know,
yeah.
And I know exactly what kind of trumpet Miles played throughout his whole career. They didn't have any of those props right. But, again, right, you know, if you're going to make an action fantasy movie, I guess those things become a little important. The most important thing is, all the people that never heard about Miles Davis, which is, unfortunately, you would never think of, because as much as we're into this, as much as we love that, he's huge to us.
Sure.
There's still a lot of people in the country, in the world, that don't know. So they learned a little something about who this guy was, and maybe they listened to made them want to go hear some of his records and understand the greatness the man brought to the world through music.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I say about that.
That's beautiful. That
wasn't, yeah. You know what I mean? I think I know Miles enough to know that he would have thought, yeah, if he saw that.
I love it. That's such a fresh take. I saw it myself, and of course, I had all kinds of critical qualms with the thing. But I did say, because everybody's asking me, should I go and all that, I said, look, man, just to have a cat on screen called Miles Davis for 2 hours is a complete gas. So
yeah, exactly. If I didn't know Miles, I'd probably have went and seen that movie and just thought, man, come on, this is what happened? You know, they're not talking about it. Where's Dizzy and, you know, all those things.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
I already knew ahead of time. You know, and I'm a big Chet Baker fan, too, and they came out with that book, you know. And I didn't know Chet. I read enough books and things about him.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very disappointed with that movie, you know.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. But, mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, these movies, you know, just like Bird they like to focus on a lot of negativity, but at the same time, these were some of those things were true things that were going on, right?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
You know.
Well, the shooting scene, I thought, you know, they kind of fictionalized that, but there is the actual event around the Blue Coronet in Brooklyn where they fired some bullets into Miles' car and between the...
Right, at him.
Yeah.
But he wasn't running around chasing people with a gun.
No,
made that.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, you mentioned books, so let me ask you, is there a Miles book besides maybe the autobiography by Miles and Quincy Troupe that you like?
That's probably my favorite,
because
It's Miles Worth.
Sure.
When I was with Miles, they were still working on that. They were just finishing it. And, you know, I remember hearing some of the tapes that Quincy, because Miles just talked forever on a tape recorder.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And Quincy kind of chronologically, you know, put everything together. And it blew my mind that every word of that was Miles. Like, he remembered every one of those sessions, what tunes he recorded, who was on them. And it's crazy. I mean, all the things he did, you know.
Mm.
And and the other thing was is you know, he made a big deal about never looking back and all that, which I respect. But at the same time, he realized that what he had done, you know, was in the 50s and the 60s was some of the greatest work ever done in the history of music. He knew.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He said a lot of stuff, that old stuff, this, that, the other thing, some other choice words. But when I was with him, that's all we talked about. We didn't talk about anything else other than, you know, what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he knew that's where I was at and where I was coming from. And I think he enjoyed talking about, because I was so hip about the history. He would say to me all the time, how do you know that? How do you know?
And you were, what, about 16 or 17 at the time?
I was 17.
Yeah.
I was 17. You know, and he told me one time, he said it. He said, you know, now we like to play, you know, vamps and grooves and play over top. He said, but what we were doing back then was some serious music. And, you know, he used to say, I'm too tired to do that.
You know, when I was listening to the Tutu concert clip this morning, I heard you play, I think, a little lick from a Charlie Parker tune. And does that ring a bell with you?
Oh, you did.
Huh?
Yeah, and you see me kind of look back at Miles.
Exactly.
Yeah. I used to do that stuff all the time, and he would be laughing, you know.
Cool.
Yeah, I used to do those type of things. Yeah, it was a great time. A lot of fun.
Mm.
Very fortunate to be there.
It looked like you were having a ball. So that's about going to wrap it up for today. I think I could hang with you and talk forever on this glorious music and your great career. And Joey, I can't thank you enough for just in fact, let's take a couple of extra minutes, because I just want to bring it back to you know, your significance in what's kind of like what was really kind of a resurgence of popularity and prominence of the B3 in jazz. When I began listening to the music, it was late 60s, early 70s. I lived in Worcester, Massachusetts. We had a couple of clubs, and the Kitty Cat Lounge was where I was hanging out, and they had a B3 there, and it was prominent in the sessions every Thursday night and Sunday evening because we had a monster player named Al Arsenault in the city who had been on the road with Lou Donaldson, and he played with a lot of rock and roll groups and stuff, but he was with Lou, too, and, you know, and he was right in that tradition. So that was one of the earliest experiences that I had personally with the music was hearing a B3 up close and in action, and of course the audience loved that sound. It was really the kind of the signature sound of that club and that scene. And then it really went kind of underground, and you, I think, really need to be deserve credit for helping to bring it back into a wonderful prominence in the music. Can you accept an acknowledgement like that?
You know, Tom, I do, and I do very humbly, because you know, when I was playing a lot of piano too, you know, like because when I started going to the creative and performing arts high school, they didn't have an organ in there. But when I grew up, I had an electric piano. I had a Fender Rhodes, but you know, it was organ and Fender Rhodes what I had, and I was in love with the Hammond organ, like I still am. So, but I had to learn how to play piano. I had to teach my left hand to play chords and things because.
Sure.
You know, when you're playing the organ, you're playing bass line with your left hand most of the time. So it was a good thing for me because, you know, I could play piano just as comfortably. And they're totally different instruments, you know. So I learned how to do it. And so piano became a big deal for me for a while. That was what I was doing. I mean, when I was at home, I still was playing the organ a lot. And I would still play some organ gigs and things in Philly. But primarily, I was a piano player in people's eyes at that point because of school and all the events we would do. And, you know, I had Chris McBride now playing bass with us. You know, that's what was happening. So I made it a point when I did my first demo for Columbia Records to play organ on there because that was my voice. That's really what I love to play. And I knew there's a million guys playing piano, but there was nobody playing organ at that point. I mean, when I say nobody, you know, all the cats were playing it, but there was this big resurgence in jazz, you know, the Young Lions, this, that, and the other thing. And I was like, man, there's nobody playing any organ. I mean, I got to play the organ. That's my sound. That's my voice. So I did the Thelonious Monk competition, the first one. Piano competition, and I was one of the five finalists in it. So I got fourth place, which means you don't get anything.
Was that the year that Ted Rosenthal won?
No, this was the first year Marcus Roberts won.
Oh, okay. Yeah
Marcus Roberts.
Who else were the finalists?
John Colaiani was third place, but there was a guy from I think he was from either Amsterdam or Denmark that took second place, and I can't remember his name, but he was bad, bad player. So,
who was number five?
I was fourth place because we took. It was me and John Colaiani were they made us come out and play again, you know. But I was 15 years old, so I, you know, what did I care, man? Just happy to be there, you know. But the cool thing was Dr. George Butler was there from. Sony,
sure.
Columbia Records. It wasn't Sony yet. And he showed a little bit of interest, I guess, because I was a young guy playing straight-ahead jazz piano, but he had just signed Harry Connick. I met him there that night, too. So he said, you know, keep me informed of what you're doing and things like that. And, you know, so I said, okay. So that was, I sent him a tape. I went in the studio. And I sent him a tape. But when I sent him the tape, I was playing organ on it. I said, I'm going to send him what I really do, you know. And even my dad, what are you doing that for? The organ, nobody's interested in that anymore. I said, this is what I want to do, Pop. You know, this is it, you know. So I did it. And I sent him the tape. And, you know, it's a great story. I'll always remember. And he got the tape. And I remember calling his office. It was the day right before Christmas Eve, you know, like he was getting ready to have that Christmas holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And his office acknowledged that they received the package. And, you know, Mr. Butler will, you know, let you know that he heard it sometime after the first of the year. Okay, that could have meant anything. Could have meant nothing, too, right?
Right, sure.
Well, I guess something made him put that tape in. He called Christmas Eve and offered me a recording contract. He said, don't make any moves.
Mm.
I want to sign you. He said, I can't believe what you're doing. This organ, he just killed me. He said, I put this on in my car. And he said, I've been swinging all the way home. And I can't believe this is Fred. I haven't heard anybody do this. He just really went crazy over it. So I was so happy. I can't tell you. You know, in my mind, I was 16 at the time.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, I'm going to make these records. I'm going to sell millions of records. You know, kid. And we did that first record, and it came out. Everybody, it was a really great success because you have people that didn't even know that organ could be played like that, right? They thought I was the first guy ever to do it. Then you had the whole slew of people that missed it. They missed hearing it, you know?
Because
even though Jimmy Smith and McGriff and McDuff, they were all still doing the circuit, but they weren't being very prolific with recordings.
Right.
The record companies weren't allowing that, you know? And Hammond organs weren't being produced anymore since 1975 the way they were supposed to be produced at that point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So here comes a major record label with a young guy playing in the spirit of the tradition of these cats and then playing it a little different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. And then a whole bunch of guys now have come out of that, you know.
It's amazing, yeah.
You know, it is. And it's a treat for me. And same time, it's a responsibility to keep pushing and keep fresh, you know.
Right.
Because I got a lot to do yet.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to hearing more of what you've got to do. And again, thanks so much for all you've given us so far, musically and soulfully. And we're really looking forward to seeing you. It's just a week from Saturday, August 6th, at Court Square in downtown Springfield. It's just the third annual Jazz and Roots Festival, but the last 2 years have been fabulously successful and have brought out a huge crowd into downtown Springfield, and the weather's been great, and I'm anticipating more of the same for the 6th. But no matter what, we'll dig hearing you that day, Joey. I look forward to I'll be introducing you that day anyway, but we'll have a chance to say hello. So thanks for joining us today.
Oh, wonderful. Mm. Thank you, Tom.
All right, and we'll see you on the 6th.
All right. I'm looking forward to it.
Likewise, and all good wishes. Thanks to Gloria, too, for helping set this up.
Oh, I'll tell her.
Okay, man. Take care. Thank you.
For additional material and recordings, visit the jazz blog at nepr.net. For Jazz Beat, I'm Tom Reaney.